All concerned played this comedy prettily. Vito poured wine, called for cakes, wrung Mr. Roberto's hand and praised his warm heart. Mr. Roberto sighed and said that having made the acquaintance of such a man as Vito Corleone restored his faith in human nature. Finally, they tore themselves away from each other. Mr. Roberto, his bones turned to jelly with fear at his narrow escape, caught the streetcar to his home in the Bronx and took to his bed. He did not reappear in his tenements for 3 days. Vito Corleone was now a man of respect in the neighborhood. He was reputed to be a member of the Mafia of Sicily. One day, a man who ran card games in a furnished room came to him and voluntarily paid him $20 each week for his friendship. He had only to visit the game once or twice a week to let the players understand they were under his protection. Store owners who had problems with young hoodlums asked him to intercede. He did so and was properly rewarded. Soon he had the enormous income for that time and place of $100 a week. Since Clemenza and Tessio were his friends, his allies, he had to give them each part of the money, but this he did without being asked. Finally, he decided to go into the olive oil importing business with his boyhood chum, Genco Abbondando. Genco would handle the business, the importing of the olive oil from Italy, the buying at the proper price, the storing in his father's warehouse. Genco had the experience for this part of the business. Clemenza and Tessio would be the salesmen. They would go to every Italian grocery store in Manhattan, then Brooklyn, then the Bronx, to persuade store owners to stock Genco Pura olive oil. With typical modesty, Vito Corleone refused to name the brand after himself. Vito, of course, would be the head of the firm since he was supplying most of the capital. He also would be called in on special cases where store owners resisted the sales talks of Clemenza and Tessio. Then Vito Corleone would use his own formidable powers of persuasion. For the next few years, Vito Corleone lived that completely satisfying life of a small businessman, wholly devoted to building up his commercial enterprise in a dynamic, expanding economy. He was a devoted father and husband, but so busy he could spare his family little of his time. As Genco Pura olive oil grew to become the best-selling imported Italian oil in America, his organization mushroomed. Like any good salesman, he came to understand the benefits of undercutting his rivals in price, barring them from distribution outlets by persuading store owners to stock less of their brands. Like any good businessman, he aimed at holding a monopoly by forcing his rivals to abandon the field or by merging with his own company. However, since he had started off relatively helpless economically, since he did not believe in advertising, relying on word of mouth, and since, if truth be told, his olive oil was no better than his competitors, he could not use the common strangleholds of legitimate businessmen. He had to rely on the force of his own personality and his reputation as a man of respect. Even as a young man, Vito Corleone became known as a man of reasonableness. He never uttered a threat. He always used logic that proved to be irresistible. He always made certain that the other fellow got his share of the profit. Nobody lost. He did this, of course, by obvious means. Like many businessmen of genius, he learned that free competition was wasteful, monopoly efficient. And so he simply set about achieving that efficient monopoly. There were some oil wholesalers in Brooklyn, men of fiery temper, headstrong, not amenable to reason, who refused to see, to recognize the vision of Vito Corleone, even after he had explained everything to them with the utmost patience and detail. With these men, Vito Corleone threw up his hands in despair and sent Tessio to Brooklyn to set up a headquarters and solve the problem. Warehouses were burned. Truckloads of olive green oil were dumped to form lakes in the cobbled waterfront streets. One rash man, an arrogant Milanese with more faith in the police than a saint has in Christ, actually went to the authorities with a complaint against his fellow Italians, breaking the 10-century-old law of Omerta. But before the matter could progress any further, the wholesaler disappeared, never to be seen again, leaving behind, deserted, his devoted wife and three children, who, God be thanked, were fully grown and capable of taking over his business and coming to terms with the Genco Pura Olive Oil Company. But great men are not born great. They grow great. And so it was with Vito Corleone. When Prohibition came to pass and alcohol forbidden to be sold, Vito Corleone made the final step from a quite ordinary, somewhat ruthless businessman to a great don in the world of criminal enterprise. It did not happen in a day. It did not happen in a year. But by the end of the Prohibition period and the start of the Great Depression, Vito Corleone had become the godfather, the Don, Don Corleone. It started casually enough. By this time, the Genco Pura Olive Oil Company had a fleet of 6 delivery trucks. Through Clemenza, Vito Corleone was approached by a group of Italian bootleggers who smuggled alcohol and whiskey in from Canada. They needed trucks and delivery men to distribute their produce over New York City. They needed delivery men who were reliable, discreet, and of a certain determination and force. They were willing to pay Vito Corleone for his trucks and for his men. The fee was so enormous that Vito Corleone cut back drastically on his oil business to use the trucks almost exclusively for the service of the bootlegger smugglers. This despite the fact that these gentlemen had accompanied their offer with a silky threat. But even then, Vito Corleone was so mature a man that he did not take insult at a threat or become angry and refuse a profitable offer because of it. He evaluated the threat, found it lacking in conviction, and lowered his opinion of his new partners because they had been so stupid to use threats where none were needed. This was useful information to be pondered at its proper time. Again, he prospered, but more important, he acquired knowledge and contacts and experience, and he piled up good deeds as a banker piles up securities. For in the following years, it became clear that Vito Corleone was not only a man of talent, but, in his way, a genius. He made himself the protector of the Italian families who set themselves up as small speakeasies in their homes, selling whiskey at 15 cents a glass to bachelor laborers. He became godfather to Mrs. Colombo's youngest son when the lad made his confirmation and gave a handsome present of a $20 gold piece. Meanwhile, since it was inevitable that some of his trucks be stopped by the police, Genco Abbondando hired a fine lawyer with many contacts in the police department and the judiciary. A system of payoffs was set up, and soon the Corleone organization had a sizable sheet, the list of officials entitled to a monthly sum. When the lawyer tried to keep this list down, apologizing for the expense, Vito Corleone reassured him. "No, no," he said. "Get everyone on it, even if they can't help us right now. I believe in friendship, and I am willing to show my friendship first." As time went by, the Corleone empire became larger. More trucks were added. The sheet grew longer. Also, the men working directly for Tessio and Clemenza grew in number. The whole thing was becoming unwieldy. Finally, Vito Corleone worked out a system of organization. He gave Clemenza and Tessio each the title of capo regime, or captain, and the men who worked beneath them the rank of soldier. He named Genco Abbondando his counselor, or consigliere. He put layers of insulation between himself and any operational act. When he gave an order, it was to Genco or to one of the capo regimes alone. Rarely did he have a witness to any order he gave any particular one of them. Then he split Tessio's group and made it responsible for Brooklyn. He also split Tessio off from Clemenza and made it clear over the years that he did not want the two men to associate even socially, except when absolutely necessary. He explained this to the more intelligent Tessio, who caught his drift immediately, though Vito explained it as a security measure against the law. Tessio understood that Vito did not want his two capo-regimes to have any opportunity to conspire against him, and he also understood there was no ill will involved, merely a tactical precaution. In return, Vito gave Tessio a free hand in Brooklyn, while he kept Clemenza's Bronx fief very much under his thumb. Clemenza was the braver, more reckless, the crueler man despite his outward jollity and needed a tighter rein. The Great Depression increased the power of Vito Corleone, and indeed, it was about the time he came to be called Don Corleone. Everywhere in the city, honest men begged for honest work in vain. Proud men demeaned themselves and their families to accept official charity from a contemptuous officialdom. But the men of Don Corleone walked the streets with their heads held high, their pockets stuffed with silver and paper money, with no fear of losing their jobs. And even Don Corleone, that most modest of men, could not help feeling a sense of pride. He was taking care of his world, his people. He had not failed those who depended on him and gave him the sweat of their brows, risked their freedom and their lives in his service. And when an employee of his was arrested and sent to prison by some mischance, that unfortunate man's family received a living allowance, and not a miserly, beggarly, begrudging pittance, but the same amount the man earned when free. This, of course, was not pure Christian charity. Not his best friends would have called Don Corleone a saint from heaven. There was some self-interest in this generosity. An employee sent to prison knew he had only to keep his mouth shut, and his wife and children would be cared for. He knew that if he did not inform to the police, a warm welcome would be his when he left prison. There would be a party waiting in his home, the best of food, homemade ravioli, wine, pastries, with all his friends and relatives gathered to rejoice in his freedom. And sometime during the night, the consigliere, Genco Abbondando, or perhaps even the Don himself, would drop by to pay his respects to such a stalwart, take a glass of wine in his honor, and leave a handsome present of money so that he could enjoy a week or two of leisure with his family before returning to his daily toil. Such was the infinite sympathy and understanding of Don Corleone. It was at this time that the Don got the idea that he ran his world far better than his enemies ran the greater world, which continually obstructed his path. And this feeling was nurtured by the poor people of the neighborhood who constantly came to him for help. To get on the home relief, to get a young boy a job or out of jail, to borrow a small sum of money desperately needed, to intervene with landlords who, against all reason, demanded rent from jobless tenants. Don Vito Corleone helped them all. Not only that, he helped them with goodwill, with encouraging words to take the bitter sting out of the charity he gave them. It was only natural, then, that when these Italians were puzzled and confused on who to vote for to represent them in the state legislature, in the city offices, in the Congress, they should ask the advice of their friend, Don Corleone, their godfather. And so he became a political power, to be consulted by practical party chiefs. He consolidated this power with a far-seeing statesmanlike intelligence by helping brilliant boys from poor Italian families through college, boys who would later become lawyers, assistant district attorneys, and even judges. He planned for the future of his empire with all the foresight of a great national leader. The repeal of prohibition dealt this empire a crippling blow, but again he had taken his precautions. In 1933, he sent emissaries to the man who controlled all the gambling activities of Manhattan, the crap games on the docks, the shylocking that went with it as hot dogs go with baseball games, the bookmaking on sports and horses, the illicit gambling houses that ran poker games, the policy or numbers racket of Harlem. This man's name was Salvatore Maranzano, and he was one of the acknowledged pezzo novante, 90 calibers or big shots of the New York underworld. The Corleone emissaries proposed to Maranzano an equal partnership beneficial to both parties. Vito Corleone, with his organization, his police, and political contacts, could give the Maranzano operations a stout umbrella and the new strength to expand into Brooklyn and the Bronx. But Maranzano was a short-sighted man and spurned the Corleone offer with contempt. The great Al Capone was Maranzano's friend, and he had his own organization, his own men, plus a huge war chest. He would not brook this upstart whose reputation was more that of a parliamentary debater than a true mafioso. Maranzano's refusal touched off the Great War of 1933, which was to change the whole structure of the underworld in New York City. At first glance, it seemed an uneven match. Salvatore Maranzano had a powerful organization with strong enforcers. He had a friendship with Capone in Chicago and could call on help in that quarter. He also had a good relationship with the Tattaglia family, which controlled prostitution in the city and what there was of the thin drug traffic at that time. He also had political contacts with powerful business leaders who used as enforcers to terrorize the Jewish unionists in the garment center and the Italian anarchist syndicates in the building trades. Against this, Don Corleone could throw two small but superbly organized regimes led by Clemenza and Tessio. His political and police contacts were negated by the business leaders who would support Maranzano. But in his favor was the enemy's lack of intelligence about his organization. The underworld did not know the true strength of his soldiers, and even were deceived that Tessio in Brooklyn was a separate and independent operation. And yet, despite all this, it was an unequal battle until Vito Corleone evened out the odds with one master stroke. Maranzano sent a call to Capone for his two best gunmen to come to New York to eliminate the upstart. The Corleone family had friends and intelligence in Chicago who relayed the news that the two gunmen were arriving by train. Vito Corleone dispatched Luca Brasi to take care of them, with instructions that would liberate the strange man's most savage instincts. Brasi and his people, four of them, received the Chicago hoods at the railroad station. One of Brasi's men procured and drove a taxicab for the purpose, and the station porter carrying the bags led the Capone men to this cab. When they got in, Brasi and another of his men crowded in after them, guns ready, and made the two Chicago boys lie on the floor. The cab drove to a warehouse near the docks that Brasi had prepared for them. The two Capone men were bound hand and foot, and small bath towels were stuffed into their mouths to keep them from crying out. Then Brasi took an axe from its place against the wall and started hacking at one of the Capone men. He chopped the man's feet off, then the legs at the knees, then the thighs where they joined the torso. Brasi was an extremely powerful man, but it took him many swings to accomplish his purpose. By that time, of course, the victim had given up the ghost, and the floor of the warehouse was slippery with the hacked fragments of his flesh and the gouting of his blood. When Brasi turned to his second victim, he found further effort unnecessary. The second Capone gunman, out of sheer terror, had, impossibly, swallowed the bath towel in his mouth and suffocated. The bath towel was found in the man's stomach when the police performed their autopsy to determine the cause of death. A few days later in Chicago, the Capones received a message from Vito Corleone. It was to this effect: "You know now how I deal with enemies. Why does a Neapolitan interfere in a quarrel between two Sicilians? If you wish me to consider you as a friend, I owe you a service which I will pay on demand. A man like yourself must know how much more profitable it is to have a friend who, instead of calling on you for help, takes care of his own affairs and stands ever ready to help you in some future time of trouble. If you do not wish my friendship, so be it. But then I must tell you, the climate in this city is damp, unhealthy for Neapolitans, and you are advised never to visit it." The arrogance of this letter was a calculated one. The Don held the Capones in small esteem as stupid, obvious cutthroats, His intelligence informed him that Capone had forfeited all political influence because of his public arrogance and the flaunting of his criminal wealth. The Don knew, in fact, was positive, that without political influence, without the camouflage of society, Capone's world, and others like it, could be easily destroyed. He knew Capone was on the path to destruction. He also knew that Capone's influence did not extend beyond the boundaries of Chicago, terrible and all-pervading as that influence there might be. The tactic was successful. Not so much because of its ferocity, but because of the chilling swiftness, the quickness of the Don's reaction. If his intelligence was so good, any further moves would be fraught with danger. It was better, far wiser, to accept the offer of friendship with its implied payoff. The Capones sent back word that they would not interfere. The odds were now equal, and Vito Corleone had earned an enormous amount of respect throughout the United States underworld with his humiliation of the Capones. For 6 months, he outgeneraled Maranzano. He raided the crap games under that man's protection, located his biggest policy banker in Harlem, and had him relieved of a day's play not only in money, but in records. He engaged his enemies on all fronts. Even in the garment centers, he sent Clemenza and his men to fight on the side of the unionists against the enforcers on the payroll of Maranzano and the owners of the dress firms. And on all fronts, his superior intelligence and organization made him the victor. Clemenza's jolly ferocity, which Corleone employed judiciously, also helped him turn the tide of battle. And then Don Corleone sent the held-back reserve of the Tessio regime after Maranzano himself.